Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte. This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles, just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
Hi, I'm Mark Striegel, host and producer of this show since 2005. On this episode, we're going to talk some rock, some metal, and
anything else we feel like.
We're also going to jam some tunes, have a drink, and share some honest opinions. Thanks for listening to the Talking Metal Podcast. Let's get things started.
Hey guys, welcome to another edition of the Talking Metal Podcast. My name is Mark Striegel. What is going on? We are here at, I guess, kind of nearing the end of the summer. August 18th is the day I am recording this little host wrap here, and I'm going to post this the same day. Kind of no frills. We're not doing any music today. We're just going to talk rock with Greg Renoff. What better a person to do that with? This guy, of course, wrote the great book Van Halen Rising, which I truly enjoyed a number of years back. And then more recently, I mean, one of the few good things that happened in 2020 was that Greg and Ted Templeman, the world famous producer, released his autobiography. Ted Templeman's autobiography, and it is an awesome read/listen. I listened to it on Audible. Ted Templeman, A Platinum Producer's Life in Music, is a must-read for any fan of rock. And this book got me so excited about music that I would have normally probably never went and looked for. I mean, for example, like Nicolette Larson. And you know, I knew the big hit single from her that Neil Young had written. I knew about that song because it was like a disco hit when I was a kid. I guess I'd call it a disco hit, 70s soft rock disco hit. But little did I know, like I didn't know Eddie Van Halen played guitar on that debut record from her. He's on a song called Can't Get Away From You. If you go listen to that on Apple Music or Spotify, you will distinctively hear the guitar stylings of Eddie Van Halen that just sound that no one else can get, and if they do, you know, they're one of the few. But and especially not in 1978 when he did the Nicolette Larson record and the debut Van Halen record. I mean, the guitars aren't quite as booming as they would be on a Van Halen record, but that's not Nicolette's style. But you know, I knew Eddie had done other things outside of Van Halen, not really a lot, but a little bit here and there. I never knew about this, and that's something really cool I discovered in the Ted Templeman, A Platinum Producer's Life in Music book by Greg Renoff and, of course, Ted. So, without further ado, again, we're not doing any music today. I'm sort of on vacation, not really, like it's a working vacation because I got hired to do Metal Crush. And this is my last week on Metal Crush. My last paid day with Sci-Fi is Friday, and that's because they hired me to do 4 episodes. And the final and 4th episode has to be turned in, and it goes live on Monday. So, of course, if you follow my Twitter, I will be sending that out. on Monday. We got Corey Taylor from Slipknot on that episode. It's a great episode. So please stay tuned for that. Metal Crush. And like it and share it and tweet Sci-Fi and tell them to bring it back for more. Bring Mark Striegel back to do more Metal Crush episodes, right? Because I want to do more. It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of hard work. It was 6-7 day work weeks and long hours. But I enjoyed it immensely, especially considering I was working retail before that. My television career had kind of gone on hold for a bit. So this has really been a great experience doing another TV production job. I appreciate anybody who watched them. If you didn't, it's not too late. There's 4 episodes up on YouTube. Actually, 3 right now. As of next week, there'll be 4. So yeah, thanks, guys. And let's do this. This is my chat with Greg Renoff. Check him out on Twitter, and I'll link that in the show notes on talkingrock.net. Check me out on Twitter. Talking Metal is my handle. I'm trying to get more interaction on Twitter. It's weird. I get interaction on Facebook and Instagram, but for some reason, I feel like I don't excite people on Twitter, so I'm trying to figure out how to do that. So, yeah, retweet me or engage me in conversation, and I'm definitely there for you on Twitter. All right, here we go. Greg Renoff, Mark Striegel, talking Ted Templeman here on Talking Metal. Hey, it's Mark Striegel, and I've really, really been enjoying a book lately. I'm actually listening to it on Audible. It is just about done with it. Amazing listen and read. Ted Templeman, A Platinum Producer's Life in Music, and we are joined by Greg Renoff here, who worked with Ted on the book, wrote the book with Ted. How are you, Greg?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on, Mark.
Man, thanks for being here. I got to ask you, who does the voiceover for the Audible version? Because he's so perfect.
Yeah, you know, it's ECW Press, which publishes the books, sells the rights off to a publishing company. And, you know, it's something that's completely out of my control or pay grade. So I'm glad you like it, because it's always just like, here's what's happening. It's never, you know, people have sort of asked me about, you know, who voices the books that you get to pick. And no, yeah, I forget, is it Runnett? Dave, forget his first last name. I think his first name, last name is Runnett. But yeah, right. He did a good job.
Yeah, I don't know what
Sean Runnett, that's his name.
What type of reaction you're getting to him, but I really like his voice. I think it works good with this. And what a story this guy has. I mean, I knew about Ted, you know, the Doobie Brothers, Van Halen, but you know, there was so much I'd forgotten, like Clapton and the Aerosmith album, and so much stuff in there. Let's go back to the beginning. And I know we don't have all night to talk about this, and I know my listeners are hard rockers, so we will try to focus on that stuff. But first of all, let me tell you that the reason this book takes me a little bit longer to get through is because it's so awesome and gets me so excited about the music that I have to put put it down and go listen to the entire Captain Beefheart record 3 times, you know, and then go back to the book, you know, because it gets you that excited about the music.
Yeah, you know, for me, it's great to hear. I spent a lot of time, obviously, talking to Ted about these records, and you mentioned the Captain Beefheart record. I had never heard the Captain Beefheart record before I started talking to Ted about his life. I knew it probably from the discography. I'd probably seen it, like, oh yeah, Clear Spot. I'd never listened to it. And he said, oh yeah, Don and I did it. And he started telling me these crazy stories about working with Beefheart. And, you know, then it's, you know, I had to sort of immerse myself in this music to be able to write the book, because he would be talking about songs and I'd have to really listen to the record from front back numerous times. So I understand what you're saying, because I would spend, you know, I'd take a walk and I'd listen to the Captain Beefheart record and come back and I'd call Ted and talk to Ted about it. So yeah, that was one of the real pleasures for me, actually, was to be able to dive into a lot of this music that, beyond the, as you mentioned, the stuff, the Aerosmith, the Van Halen, that I was more familiar with, obviously, from growing up listening to those records, to listen to the more wide-ranging things that Ted had done. It was fantastic for me to kind of go, oh my God, this is really, really, really cool. The rhythms on the rhythm stuff on the Captain Beefheart and the bizarre vocals and, you know, the lyrics and just the whole very different type of music that I would normally listen to that I ended up loving. So it was cool.
Yeah. And I mean, what a life this guy's had. I mean, it's really incredible. Like, and it's not just the music, it's hanging out with, you know, Governor Brown and Linda Ronstadt and the Laurel Canyon scene and growing up in California and going on a crazy, like, what was it? Like a 3-month European trip when he was younger. I mean, I listen to this, I'm like, wow, this guy has lived. This guy has truly lived. The car crash he had growing up listening to jazz. Where did he grow up in California again?
Santa Cruz.
And is that...
So that's like Central Coast.
Right. Is that where the Doobies were from?
They're from basically from San Jose, but it's the same neck of the woods, right? So it's, I think that's one of the reasons why they connected when they met, was that they basically grew up, you know, in the same general area of California together. Yeah.
So Harper's Bazaar, I mean, we'll fast forward to that because this is the band that Ted had. He was in the band and he scores a number one hit with this band, right?
I don't think it was a number one, but it was a big Billboard hit. It was like top 10 Billboard single, you know, and this is the main Billboard hit chart. So yeah, this was in 1967. They had a song called Feeling Groovy.
Simon and Garfunkel.
Yeah, the cover song. And so they did a vocal soft rock version of it, and it really, really took off. And so Ted, being, you know, kind of just an unknown musician to a guy who was on all sorts of late night shows, got to play with an incredible array of people. I mean, I think it's, you know, obviously anyone listens to the show like Bob Hope, Raquel Welch, they became sort of the band of the moment as like a soft kind of like the Association of the Fifth Dimension, if people know those groups, you know, and they had their moment in the sun, and they really did a lot of touring. They toured with the Beach Boys, so they got to do some really cool stuff.
Yeah, and they go from, you know, basically being a band that was selling places out to, you know, what, like 3 years later, they're really down and out. I mean, they're playing to like 30 people in clubs or a casino or somewhere, right? Was that in Reno? I'm trying to remember where that was.
Yeah, there's the casinos, yeah.
Yeah, and so at this point, he kind of is already thinking about producing, right? So he is going to sessions, I guess, down in the Los Angeles area, and he drops in on some really incredible talents. I mean, superstars of that time, people like Sinatra and Elvis. And I thought it was really cool that one thing he observed in the studio with both of those guys is they really kind of controlled the scene when they came in to the studio. Any memories you can share from the book on either one of those guys and Ted's encounters with them?
Yeah. So Ted was kind of becoming a studio junkie. You know, the thing is that's interesting about those albums, and I thought people might want to hear this when we talked, is that, you know, at the time, most of the albums that were done that were on the hit charts were done with session musicians. So the people probably heard of the Wrecking Crew, which was kind of the grade A top guys in LA in the late 60s into the 70s who would get called for every single session. So you might have a band and they might be able to play, but it's like, well, we could have them play and have to spend 4 or 5 hours just trying to get a drum track down, or we can have these guys do it, you know, in 15 minutes and get the drums done. So, you know, when Ted performed on a record, he only sang, but unlike some of the other guys in his band, he really got interested in the entire process of making records. And instead of like doing his part and leaving, he stayed from beginning to end and would watch the session musicians play. And so he sort of became a studio junkie. And this is how he ended up meeting a lot of the engineers who worked at the big studios in LA. And that's how the Sinatra and the Elvis thing both happened. Both times he kind of got a tip from the engineers who were working on these records, go, hey, hang around, Sinatra's coming in, or hey, Elvis is going to be here tonight, you should come down. And he got to see, Elvis and Sinatra record in L.A.
Tina Turner, right?
Tina Turner. And so he got to see these really, you know, incredible legendary talents. And I think that was part of what, you know, set Ted afire as the whole studio addiction thing, where he really wanted to do this as a career and began to realize that over time that as a vocalist and as a musician, he probably didn't have the talent to sustain like a long career. You know, especially when he was thinking about the guys he was comparing himself to, he just didn't think, you know, I can sing, but I can't sing like Sinatra. I can, you know, I can play drums, but I can't play drums like the guys in the Wrecking Crew, he wanted to try to transition to doing something where he'd be on the other side of the glass.
Right on. And I remember he says about Sinatra came into the studio and just didn't, you know, here's Ted, an unknown, kind of hanging out in the studio, and Sinatra comes up to him and is like, how do you like my shoes?
Yeah, that was one of the best stories Ted told me. Yeah, that like Sinatra, like he was staring at Sinatra, and Sinatra kind of walked over to him and said, hey, kid, come here. You know, like, how do you like my shoes? They look great, Mr. Sinatra. Thanks. You know, I just got them and like walked into the studio. Yeah. You know, Ted said he was just blown away. And I think in part that was one of the things that really made Ted want to make records too, seeing someone like Sinatra, where it was done, where there was really, you know, it wasn't necessarily all one take, but everyone was in the same room together. It was an orchestra with a huge band, and he got up there and sang with all of those musicians in the room. And it was, you know, it was in effect a live session. You know, that was, yeah. I think that part of what captured Ted's imagination too is like, wow, you know, this is what you can do when you're really talented and you have a great team of people around, a musician of that caliber. And I think that really, it was just blew Ted away too.
And I think the song he was recording, to tie it into David Lee Roth, who was That's Life, right?
Yes, yes,
which
exactly.
is kind of interesting.
One of the songs had heard, Ted was there a couple of times, and this is for the making of the That's Life record, for a couple of the sessions for that record, and he heard them cut. Yeah, That's Life, which is amazing.
Which, of course, is the song that closed Eat 'Em and Smile many years later. Again, just so many great stories, and we're encouraging everyone to pick up this incredible book, one of the best reads I've experienced in a while. Ted Templeman, A Platinum Producer's Life and Music. We're talking with co-author, right, Greg?
Yeah, I mean, as told to, Ted really wanted to be an as told to, which was that, you know, he didn't want people to think that, like, he sat down at the typewriter and, like, you know, typed it out. He's like, you know, he wanted to make people know that, you know, he basically talked to me, and I put the book together, and then, of course, he worked with me on that process, too. But, yeah, he was very generous about sharing credit, and people who read the book or hear the audiobook will know he's really is a guy who understands that it's appreciated by people you work with, who, you know, like they feel appreciated. And Ted was wonderful about that. He really made me feel good about doing it with him.
And we'll get to the hard rock stuff quick, but let's talk about the Doobie Brothers, a band that I've always been a casual fan of. You know, I'll be honest, yeah. I've never owned any of their music,
sure.
But China Grove comes on the radio. I love it minute by minute, the same thing, you know. And it was like, well, yeah, Michael McDonald, he was in there at some point. Like, I didn't really know, but I'm so crazed over the Doobie Brothers now. The book has caused me just to dive so hardcore into that band and what a band it was. Basically, one guy, Pat, right, was kind of the consistent through
right.
all
Correct.
The years of the Doobie Brothers. And then
Correct.
there was Tom, and then there was Michael McDonald who came in, and they never were really in the band together. I know Tom, there was like one of the albums Tom sang
right.
a song on, but it was kind of two different eras of the band, correct?
Correct. Correct. Yeah. So the Doobies had this first album that completely flopped, which Ted is the co-producer on it. And then the Doobies gave Ted a call again, and Ted was able to do the second record by himself. And that was Toulouse Street, and that's the one with Blackwater and some of the other big, big hits. And they had this huge run in the early 70s with Tom Johnson, who's kind of, you know, the guy I think a lot of people would associate with the Doobies, which would be China Grove, you know, Long Train Running. These are the hits that sort of propelled the Doobies to massive success. I mean, at one point, I think in 74, they had three albums in the top 200, four albums in the top 200 Billboard charts. I mean, they were just going great guns. And then Tom got ill, got an ulcer, and really had to go off the road because he was so sick. And that's when they brought in Mike McDonald, initially as a backup musician, which is really interesting as part of the book, too, is that the initial deal was that the Doobies were on tour and Tom Johnson got sick, and Skunk Baxter, who
right.
knew Mike McDonald from the Doobie Brothers. They had both worked on Doobie Brothers records.
No,
basically, hey, I know this.
Steely Dan, right?
Yeah, sorry. I'm sorry. Yeah, Steely Dan. My apologies. You know, basically said, like, hey, you know, I know this guy who's, you know, he's a good singer and keyboard player. And then by the end of the tour, the guys who were in the Doobies, particularly Pat Simmons, who had been, you know, who was Tom Johnson's partner as a songwriter and the vocalist, was saying, hey, you know, this guy's really good, Ted. You should hear this guy sing. And then they eventually would transition to having Mike be the front of the band while Tom had kind of stepped aside.
Right. And one of my favorite stories in there about the Doobie Brothers in the book is the song What a Fool Believes, and how they've done like 70 takes of it and they've been working on it for months. And they got to the point where they were just like, ah, the song's no good. And he takes it into the A&R department at Warner Brothers and he plays it for them. And everyone's just like, that's an amazing song. He then goes back and does what?
Yeah, that's the great story too. Yeah, the great story is that Ted talked to me quite a bit about how, you know, sometimes with a song, as a producer, it's all about this sort of like this little tiny feel that can make a huge difference in the way you think the song should be carried out. And he talked about one of the songs on the Clapton record that, you know, he said we just didn't get the feel right, meaning Lenny Waronker and Ted as the producers. He's like, it's a good song, but we just didn't quite get it right in retrospect. And What a Fool Believes was another one of these songs where Ted felt the drum part. He said he couldn't quite explain the feel he wanted to the drummers. And these are guys who are very talented drummers. And so at one point, when they're basically getting ready to go, I don't know, we're just going to have to like maybe shelve this song for the next, till the next record. Don Landy, who's Ted's right-hand man and engineered all the great records with Ted at Van Halen Records, the Doobie Brothers record, said, hey, Ted, go try to play it. Go play it. And he's like, no. He's like, go play it. So Ted got out from the control room and went and played. Ted was a drummer and played the song, and that's actually the take with Ted on drums and one of the other drummers from the Doobies playing as well that made it to the record.
And that's not credited anywhere. So the only place that I think exposes that I know of course, is your book. Because I went to Wikipedia, I went researching that. I couldn't find anything that said Ted plays the drums on What a Fool Believes.
Yeah.
I did not know that. And we also find out that he did some of the backing vocals in the studio with Van Halen. And he always, even on the Clapton record, you know, he always tended to lend his musical talents in front of the microphone too, for a lot of the people he was producing.
Yeah. One of the funny stories he told me, he always laughs about is, people appreciate this, have you ever heard Forever Man? You know, there's timbales on it. There's those like those Latin drums, and that's Ted playing them. He's like, he goes, I may have went a little overboard with that, but I was the producer.
So, yeah. You know,
so that's why I liked it. You know, because I may have had lost perspective on that, but you know, yeah, he played on a lot of stuff, performed and sang.
Yeah. And the Clapton album, I mean, I don't know if we have time to talk about everything, but it's all in this great book, A Platinum Producer's Life in Music, Ted Templeman. And we were talking with Greg Renoff, who wrote the book with him. Let's go to Montrose. So he's working with Van Morrison, does some incredible stuff with Van Morrison, which you write about in the book. But he discovers the guitar player who's working with Van Morrison at this time. And that guitar player is who, Greg?
Is Ronnie Montrose.
Right. So this is where he connects with Ronnie at these Van Morrison sessions. And I guess it would have been a couple years later, Greg, that he actually really does a hard rock record, a couple records actually, with Montrose, the band.
Yeah. So, when Van fired Ronnie went off and did the Edgar Winter album, so like Frankenstein, that amazing Edgar Winter album, that's Ronnie on guitar. But then Ted and Ronnie reconnected, and Ronnie presented this idea of kind of this hard rock band who was going to be kind of a classic quartet in the spirit of Led Zeppelin. And they put together a band, Ronnie did, and that was included a guy credited as Sam Hagar. Now, Sammy Hagar was like 19 years old at the time, and they cut this record in 1973, which was, you know, called Montrose.
Yeah, and, you know, he says in your book that, you know, the albums didn't really do as well as he was hoping, but I would point out that they were highly influential. I mean, in later in the book, you mentioned how Eddie Van Halen loved those records, and I know for a fact Steve Harris of Iron Maiden loved those records, you know, so maybe not commercial smashes, but definitely very influential records. And let's talk about Van Halen. So he discovers Van Halen. It's all in the book how this comes about, but very hard on Dave. I mean, as somebody who loves Dave, I have to admit that you guys are talking about Dave in the studio for that first album and how they really struggled with his voice. I don't know. I felt a little bad or something, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I think Ted wanted to be honest about the fact that, you know, he did a 180 on Dave. I mean, that was the thing he really wanted to be, to come out in the book, that to be like, look, you know, sometimes your first impressions of people and are incorrect, and or people can improve and you can make something work. And I think that's really what he wanted to explain, that, you know, he really did work a lot with Dave to try to get the vocals into shape for the first Van Halen record. And then to go from being, I don't know if this is the right guy for Van Halen, basically right after he signs the band, to going, there's no way Van Halen would have made it without David Lee Roth. And then to basically be fighting behind the scenes to keep Dave in the band in 1985. It's like, that's what Ted really wanted to get that, you know, be honest about that, to be like, you know, I became Dave's biggest advocate in many ways in Van Halen, you know, because I thought he was just, you know, killer. I mean, maybe not the biggest, but you know what I mean? He became like a big fan of Dave, obviously, because he thought he just, the vocals, the whole personality that came across, and the lyrics, especially how great Dave was at writing lyrics. And as a songwriter, he thought he was just the perfect, you know, obviously, as we all know, the perfect guy for Van Halen.
Yeah. And something that you kind of got at in your first book your book on Van Halen, I should say, was that, you know, Dave's attitude and vibe and everything about him, his persona, was so much of what not only became part of their sound, but just part of their success and their attitude. And I think Ted does a good job at, you know, backing that up, you know, what you kind of described in the Van Halen book.
Ted really points to the song Ain't Talking About Love. I mean, we talked about that pretty much every time we talked about Van Halen. I'm not even joking. Like, that song would come up. He just talked about how he was, you know, just blown away by the lyric that David come up with. And of course, with that riff, he said it was just like, that was to him. He was like, this is it, man. This is the thing. Because it was just so, you know, in some ways so simple, right? But he's like, the way Ed played the riff isn't really all that simple if you're a guitar player. He's like, you know, it's a simple two chord song. And the lyric is just, you know, about, like, you know, all about your disease and about, you know, fighting for what you want, even if you have to bleed for it. He said it was just like, it just hit him. And he's like, this is incredible, this band. And, you know, that was, I think the song that Ted would most point to say, if there's one song in my career I am most proud of as a producer and love the most, is actually that song.
Right on. And 1984, it gets ugly for Ted. You know, Eddie builds his own studio and they're recording the 1984 record in there. And you never come right out and say this in the book, but I mean, I kind of can read between the lines what was going on there. I mean, it seems like Don and Eddie are, I'll just say it, I mean, they're coked out of their mind, right? I mean, that's what it seems like.
I think if you read between the lines, I mean, I think the thing that would be definitely clear is that one of the things that Ted feared about, and again, Ted's honest about his own substance abuse in the book. I mean, he's never like walking around like, I was clean, I was an angel. But he feared home studio as a place where it becomes this, you know, more like a clubhouse than a studio, that you don't have a clock running anymore to finish the record. You're not paying a bill for the studio. So there's this sort of sense that you could just stretch it out and just nothing can get done. And I think that's what Ted was afraid of. And I think that's what actually in some ways came to pass in terms of the way the record got done. It just became, as Ted said, he felt like he was trying to grab lightning. Like, he just said, like, you know, trying to get a song done. And if you like didn't do it right that day, you're like, it might not happen for 2-3 weeks, like, just because things were so crazy. But yeah, it was definitely a something that was, I mean, destructive to Van Halen. I mean, I don't mean that in terms of the album.
And destructive to his relationship with Don, it seemed, who had done all these great records with him through the years.
And with Ed. I mean, to be honest with you, and with Ed too at that time, definitely. It definitely caused a lot of, you know, I think bruised egos. And I think, I know from Ted's perspective that he worked really hard on the record and felt, even when it was over, you know, he just wanted to kind of move on from the personal thing. So when 5150 was done and Ted did not produce it, and there had been a lot of, you know, kind of hard feelings around the whole production of that, who was going to produce it, and because Ted passed on it, that Don, Landy, and Ed Van Halen went to Ted's office and Ted gave his advice on sequencing it. He also did that in OU812. So, you know, again, as much as there were obviously problems, they never, like, you know, it was never like, I hate this guy, or, you know, whatever. It was never like that type of thing. But yes, Don Landy and Ted Templeman, who had worked together from 1971 up through 1983, and pretty much everything Ted did, Don and Ted did together. They stopped working together. That's true.
Right. And right after that, Insanity, he's in the studio with Clapton in New York. He's recording The Voice of America, the VOA record, with Hagar, which is interesting, too, before Hagar joins Van Halen. Then in the studio with Aerosmith, doing an album that I always loved, Done with Mirrors. I just felt like, for whatever reason, it didn't blow up like it should have. But, I mean, just mind-boggling, the stuff that this guy's done, the Clapton stuff. Who was the guy who was in the studio who was the bad influence on Clapton?
So it's Jerry Williams,
right?
Who was a songwriter?
Jerry Lynn Williams or something,
right? Who wrote
Forever Man, I think, right?
Forever Man, Show What Love Can Do. I mean, if you go through his, if you look him up on Wikipedia, people should look him up. He wrote some amazing, like pretty much all like the, you know, every, you know, like Bonnie Raitt. You go through all these different people.
Worked with Robert Plant too. Yep.
Yeah, right. All these blues rock stars in that genre. He was kind of the guy who would come up with these amazing songs. And Ted was like, this guy was an incredible, incredible songwriter. But yeah, he was kind of a mess in the studio to work with, and it was really difficult. The story from the book, of course, is that he and Clapton kind of, you know, disappear
right,
for a little
in New York City.
Yeah, for like gone. A lost weekend for themselves. So it was a little bit of an issue, but yeah, that was another really amazing, because I bought that album as a kid.
I did too. Yeah, that in August, I think, which was the one after it. I loved both those records. Yeah, cool. And so I know we're running out of time here, Greg, but tell me one thing you learned that you didn't know, because you're an expert on all this Van Halen related stuff. Tell me one thing you learned from the book, or from working with Ted on this book, about one of my all-time favorite records, Eat 'Em and Smile.
Oh, God. I mean, there's so many things. I mean, I think for me,
one of the most interesting things that you learned about that.
The interesting thing, record. Yeah. I mean, I think is that Ted was really not into the movie idea. I mean, I thought that was really interesting, too, because I don't think he'd ever talked about it. But when he talked about how, you know, it was initially supposed to be basically a soundtrack for a movie. That was the original idea, that Dave was going to do this movie, as everybody knows. And the music, a lot of the songs initially were put together, was going to be all part of like the soundtrack from the original, you know, original music for the film Eat 'Em and Smile. And that Ted hated the whole idea of doing a movie. He was like, I don't want to do this. And basically how excited he actually was to do the album, you know, because he said, I got this incredible band. So that, for me, that was one of the more intriguing things, because the recorder was always this, as you know, as a Van Halen fan, anyone who knows who read, you know, any of the magazine articles in the 80s, there's always this assumption, like, you know, that Ted was like, oh, great, you know, I got Dave, we can make movies, we can do all this stuff, we don't have to deal with Van Halen anymore, when in fact, it's actually, that's completely opposite from what Ted wanted. Ted wanted Van Halen to stay together, and in fact, Ted didn't want anything to do with the whole movie side of things. He thought it was just a waste of time.
He says at one point in the book, he says to you that he was hopeful that, you know, maybe they would just do this one record with Hagar, and then they do, you know, Eat 'Em, and Dave would go do an album or EP or maybe an album. And then that he was hopeful that, yeah, maybe once they got it out of their system, you know, in 1985, 86, they'd come back together. Or maybe, I guess it would have been, or the 85 that they would have done that. And then he was hopeful that anyways, the band would have come back together. Right. So I found that interesting and telling in how much he really, really wanted those guys to just keep it together.
I mean, I think that's the thing. I mean, even he talked about, even, you know, I said, what about the other guys in the band? He's like, look, I would have helped any of those, like Greg and Billy. He's like, I would have helped all those guys, and all of those guys would have been fine if Dave had just sort of, you know, broken up the band. But yeah, that's interesting, because I never would have suspected that either. But, you know, he kind of used the example of Aerosmith to say, you know, where Tyler and Perry kind of went their separate ways for a few years, but eventually it's like you kind of come to your senses and you're like, okay, this is the real deal. You come back, but it never happened, obviously.
Right. Great stuff, Greg. Excellent book. How long did it take you to write this?
Oh, God, I started writing it probably in earnest in 2016. So it took longer than I thought it was going to take, in part because of the things we talked about, where I really wanted to do justice to the early Doobie Brothers stuff and the Captain Beefheart and the Little Feet. And, you know, I had to do a lot of self-education to be really able to do this book the way I wanted to. So it started really in 2016, going at it to do it. And eventually, finished in 2019.
I love it. It's a page turner, man. I love every bit of it. You know, even the Jerry, like I said, the Jerry Brown stuff, the Carly Simon and Groucho Marx stuff. There's so many cool little bits of entertainment history, you know, legendary old school Hollywood stuff that is just incredible. What a life this guy has led. How's he doing health wise right now? He's obviously up there in age. What is he, 80, approaching 80?
He's 77. So okay. He's doing fine. I mean, he's just like everybody else. You know, he is kind of, especially in that demographic, they're sort of, you know, very, you know, kind of locked away. He's doing fine. I haven't seen him in a long time because actually we were supposed to do book signings in April when the book came out in California and all those got canceled, the whole right. shebang. And so, sure. You know, it's, he's doing, as far as I know, he's doing just fine, doing his thing. So
what's the last record he produced? Was it, did he go back to the Doobies? Is that
the last one he produced was World Gone Crazy.
Yeah. Which is kind of a good place to end it. Cause he started, basically started with the Doobies, ended with the Doobies.
Yep.
Yeah. Great stuff. Thank you for this book, Greg. I love it.
Oh, great. Thank you so much, Mark. I appreciate you being on.
A big thanks to Greg for joining me. Definitely pick up the book, Ted Templeman, A Platinum Producer's Life and Music. While you're at it, pick up Van Halen Rising, two must reads for any fan of Van Halen and any fan of rock in general. All right, we'll talk to you next time, guys. Enjoy the rest of your summer.